It's all golden to me.
It's my dream to have a golden beard.
Younger but looks older.
I'll even try a squat. Here we go. The 6 of clubs.
The golden.
Welcome to another episode of the Talk Golden to Me video podcast show. I am your host, as always, Evan Golden, Golden TV, from the law offices of Berman & Berman is where our studios is located. And today, I have the privilege of talking to a man that I read his book, and you see him right here in front of me. I've been just so excited to talk to this man and to meet the person behind the stories and what he's done and what he's done for our country. And he's so outspoken and really true inspiration for so many people that have been in the military and veterans. And he's really been a mouthpiece for so many people right now in the arena. So really excited to learn about this author and the man behind what they call is the Wiz. So everybody, if you are just listening, tune in now. Our viewers, get off of my face. Here he is. This is Navy fighter pilot Matthew Buckley. He's the author From Sea Level to Sea Level, and that's a sea level is a corporate level. So he's transitioned into business, to a very successful business. So thank you so much for joining us. I know you're a really busy man. We appreciate your time and can't wait to learn more about this book, what made you write it, and what the future holds for you, the Wiz.
Yes.
What's going on, sir? So let's get right into it. You are a Navy fighter pilot. Are you even allowed to tell me, you know, some of your duties and what you did and what your responsibilities were?
Absolutely, and then I have to kill you. So it depends on how much you want to know.
Certainly. So tell us a little bit about it. You went from obviously being in the Navy, flying these jets, and who knows what type of missions you've done, which I want to hear more. I read some of them in the book, but now you're into corporate America, right? Is that kind of the whole story of the author of the book here?
Well, it is, but it's interesting. We're shooting this a couple days after 9/11 because the first chapter of the book actually starts with me packing for my first flight as a pilot for American Airlines on September 11th, right on the morning of September 11th.
Oh, man.
I was packing for my trip on September 11th. I was supposed to be flying from DFW actually down here to Miami. And then on to Cancun. And
flight never took off, right?
Well, here's what happened. As I was packing, my wife at the time came in and said, "Hey, you better come take a look at the TV. Airplane hit the World Trade Center." And I'm like, "I'm busy. I'm packing." It was a small airplane in bad weather. And just the look on her face was, "You better come take a look." So I knew that look. And I went out there, and beautiful, clear day in New York City and a huge smoking hole. So I'm standing there going through my mental aviation checklist of what's happened. Boom, second plane hits, instantly knew we were under attack. So I ran into the bedroom, and I still have it. I still have it in my home office. I have my American Airlines uniform still in the plastic. Pushed that out of the way, put my flight suit on, put my boots on, and I had an old 89 Porsche. I think I broke the land speed record getting out to Naval Air Station Fort Worth. So I got out there just as they closed it and went to a combat posture. So me and another buddy from my F-18 squadron made it out there. And next door was the TANG, the Texas Air National Guard, the 457th Fighter Squadron. And they were tied into NORAD, which was a North American Air Defense. And we're a poor Navy squadron, man. We don't have anything, but the Air Force guys get everything. They had missiles and bullets. Mm-hmm. They're like, "Hey, we're going to arm your jets up. Let's all get together and brief." So here it's like Lexington and Concord, bunch of citizen soldiers, citizen airmen, two Navy guys, four Air Guard guys. We're sitting there briefing to get airborne to fly combat air patrol. And right up there in the command post on the TVs, Pentagon gets hit.
Aye, aye, aye.
I mean, I'm like, oh, my God, man.
Nightmare.
This is insanity. So I went from potentially flying in an airliner that day to shooting one down, to maybe even shooting down a squadron mate, because most of the out of the 18 guys in my reserve squadron, I think 15 of them were airborne that day. So imagine being ordered to shoot down an airliner full of us, let alone one flown by your best friend.
Can you tell me a little bit more about that you had to shoot that down?
It's really weird because the next day, September 12th, I remember going home the night of September 11th and just passing out on the couch full of adrenaline. I woke up the next day still in my flight suit, my boots. It was just – and I went back into the Red Room the next day, September 12th, and on the desk in the Red Room's kind of like the living room of the fighter squadron. Everybody's hanging out, but that day
– I've seen Top Gun.
Yeah, there you go, several times. So on the table in the Ready Room was an ATO, air tasking order. And the only other time I had seen an ATO was on the ship in the Persian Gulf. An ATO says – here's who you can kill. Here's why you can kill them. It's the rules of engagement. So laying on the table in the Ready Room was the ATO for the United States of America. It was like a freaking Charlton Heston movie, man. I'm like reading this. Anything, you know, 25 miles around Washington and New York is a free fire zone, meaning if it flies, kill it. Doesn't matter what it is.
And that was the instructions.
So I sat here in the ready room in Fort Worth, Texas, reading the rules of engagement for combat over the United States. It was a surreal moment.
They don't train you for stuff like that. That's a little on another. That's a whole other level.
It is, but as an officer in the Navy, as an aviator, you're kind of so that was instinct. You know, seeing the second plane hit, I'm like, we're under attack, go. You know, my commanding officer was a Delta pilot. He was airborne, so it's not like I was going to sit at home and wait for my skipper to call. You're taught as an officer and an aviator to execute, man. And it was an incredible day. So it's not funny. Here's how I segue from going to all this to the business world. So I got on September 14th. Remember each day after 9/11, they were trying to open the airspace. Like, hey, we're trying. No, we're not. We can't. So I'm sitting alert in the aircraft at Naval Air Station Fort Worth with another buddy fully armed up. And they scrambled us. Somebody had gotten airborne out of Waco, Texas. And President Bush's ranch, presidential ranch, so he had prohibited airspace down there. And they actually had an airborne White House, big E3, you know, kind of like an Air Force One, but with a lot more stuff on board. And some guy had gotten airborne in a plane. So we launched. We scrambled. And you're not allowed to go supersonic over America, maybe in the desert or 30 miles off the coast. As soon as we get airborne, we are supersonic. I'm over Texas, a couple thousand feet. Boom, sonic boom.
How long does it take you to get to Texas?
Well, from Fort Worth to where this guy was, a blink of an eye. But, I mean, I'm going maybe Mach 1, 1.5 over Texas. I'm looking out at my wingtips. I got live missiles. I'm over the United States with live missiles launching on a contact. So I locked this guy up. He's like 70 miles away. He's doing all of like 80 miles an hour. And I'm doing the speed of God, you know? I mean, I'm all in. So I'm trying to slow down. I pull my throttles idle, speed brake out. I'm like a dog on a kitchen floor, like, trying to slow down. It's a small airplane, and I don't think he had a radio, because some really small airplanes don't need a radio. Apparently, it was like some grandfather who thought that the airspace was open and took his grandson flying. So I finally get slow enough. The slowest I can go is about 150 knots, or I'm going to fall out of the air. And he's doing about 80. So I go by this guy, you know, kind of get down. And he finally noticed us, and he landed on a grass strip. And we kind of stayed on top of him until, like, some black Suburbans and Texas Rangers went out to his grass strip. But here's the funny part is I land. And I'm sitting in the ready room telling all my buddies about how cool I am, you know, telling them the story. My cell phone rings, and it's, you know, First Officer Buckley. And I'm like, yeah, who's this? They're like, hey, you know, this is Steve from Crew Scheduling in American. You have your first trip tomorrow. I'm like, whatever, dude. I thought it was one of my buddies in the ready room, like, playing a joke. I'm like, whatever, man. Right. He's like, what do you mean? You have your first trip tomorrow. Mm-hmm. He's like, are you refusing your trip? Which means, you know, we'll fire you. You know, you're brand new here. I'm like, dude, do you have a TV? Are you like in a cave? This is over with. You know, America, we're all. He's like, well, then you'll be fired. So I'm like, I'll be there. So September 14th, I go out to DFW, and it does look like I said, a Charlton Heston movie. I mean, there's airliners everywhere.
Yeah.
And my instructor pilot shows up, and he looks at me like, dude, what are you doing here? I wasn't even going to come. I don't even think I have a job anymore. All right. He's like, all right, let's do it. So we're flying. We launch out of DFW, and the only people on the plane were American Airlines employees who were stuck, you know, Miami-based, stuck in Dallas since the attacks. So we're essentially flying, you know, 30 people back. And on the way down, the captain's sitting there going, you know, man, I don't even know if I have a job. I'm like, dude, you got 20 years of seniority here. So the funny part is we're flying down there, and he's like, man, I got furloughed in the 90s. I was on a trip, you know, I landed in Columbus, and the chief pilot says, hey, man, you know, crew scheduling just called. I got to take your ID. You're furloughed. He's like, I didn't even get a ride home. And I was laughing about that. We land down in Miami. I'll never forget this. We go to the DoubleTree Hotel, which is the crew hotel. Mm-hmm. And I'm checking in, you know, to my room, and captain's on his cell phone over there. And I get my room key, and he comes up to me. He's like, dude, you're not going to believe this, man. That was crew scheduling, and I have to take your ID, you're furloughed. So I flew one flight for American Airlines.
That was it.
And that was it. Here's the wrap-up to it. 2-3 years ago, I'm getting so I fly around the world, fly around the country doing, you know, giving motivational speeches like that on business execution, everything like that. So I'm getting off the jet bridge. I'm flying back from the speech. I think it was a speech in Vegas. Of course, you know, since I fly a lot, I'm sitting up front, and, you know, it's a five Bloody Mary flight type of thing. And I'm getting off the jet bridge, and my cell phone rings, and it's an 817 area code, which is Fort Worth. So I'm thinking it's an old squadron mate, right? So I answer, and, it, you know, hi, this is Mary from HR at American Airlines. Is this First Officer Buckley? I'm like, I haven't heard those words, and it was 12 years at the time. She's like, oh, hey, great. Well, you know, we're calling to see if you want to come back. Because I was still on the seniority list, right? They had furloughed thousands of pilots. And she actually, they had gotten down to my name on the list. Like, hey, do you want to come back? I'm like, yeah, I'll come back. She's like, oh, great. You know, there's a class in a couple weeks. I'm like, no, no, no. I'll come back to run the damn place. I'll come back to be the CEO. I'm not coming back to be, I haven't flown an airliner in 12 years. And, you know, to be frank, the first year pay that I would have went back on was, you know, less than I had made for the speech that I did. So I said, I'm good. I think my airline career ended. So that's kind of how I was forced in the blink of an eye. You know, when I got hired by American, you know, I got a nice letter from the chief pilot, you know, color ink and sign, you know, welcome aboard. And on October 1st, 2001, I got a photocopied, like off-centered photocopy, dear crew member, you know, you're furloughed, which is polite speak.
What a fall from the grace.
Yeah, it was awful. So I had to shuck and jive, man. I mean, when you lose your health care, your rich career, airline working one day a month, and, you know, flight attendants in the Caribbean type, it was all gone in the blink of an eye. So you got to scramble. You got to, you know, I had a wife at the time and my son Matthew, who's wants to be a Marine fighter pilot. I guess I dropped him on his head when he was a kid. Wants to fly for the
following on the father's footsteps.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah. So, yeah, I had to scramble and provide and get it done.
Now, I think that a lot of employers, you know, if they're looking at candidates, I think that they maybe prefer someone to come from the military because, well, you know, look at all the benefits that come from taking direction, following orders, et cetera, mm-hmm. et cetera. You basically took everything that you've learned in the military all those years, and now you're transcending and educating people right. How they can implement that into everyday businesses. Does it work for a wide range of industries?
It does. It works for everything. Because it's not about the widget. It's not about a law firm. It's not about making cars. It's about the people and the processes. The toughest transition for me, you can have the best business plan in the world, and it's going to fail miserably if you don't have the right people. So you're right. A lot of former, you know, military folks do have that, you know, that ability to take a plan and execute it no matter what. We kind of like saying failure is not an option, right? One of the hardest transitions for me from the military to the business world, I helped run about a $2.5 billion firm up in Chicago, a trading firm. And in the military, if I looked at you and say, Evan, hey, man, I need this done by next Friday, you'd say three words to me. I got it. Now, in the military, as soon as you'd say that to me, I got it, what happens in my mind? It's done. Even though it's doing it's already done in my mind. And if it's not going to get done, hey, Wiz, can't do that by next Friday. Here's why it won't be able to happen. Here's my recommended courses of action. In the business world, I'd be like, hey, man, can you get this done? Yeah, sure. Find out a week later. There's no way in hell you did it. It didn't get done. You didn't tell me why. So those powerful words of I got it. And actually meaning it. So a lot of businesses just don't have that type of culture.
Is it procrastination? Is it no urgency? What is
accountability? See, in the military, and we hold ourselves account, especially as aviators, man, we hold ourselves accountable more than anybody else, right? I teach companies how to debrief, right? After every fighter mission, we get together behind closed doors. We take off the name tag, off the Velcro, and take off the rank. So if I'm flying with the admiral in the debrief, that dude or lady ain't an admiral. She or he's an aviator that was on that mission. So in a debrief, there are no punches pulled. Hmm. It's, hey, man.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. It's you would think if you were a fly on the wall in a debrief that we hate each other, but that's not it. First of all, in a debrief, you get to self-identify, meaning, you know, we go around the room and say, hey, guys, here's what I know I gooned up on this mission. Boom, 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 boom. And if I miss something, somebody else is going to go, hey, Wiz, did you not know that this happened too? I might not have, man. I might have been, you know, just snakes in the cockpit, man. And you know what? Thanks for pointing that out to me. I didn't know that. So in a debrief, it's not personal, it's professional. So when I try and teach debriefing in the business world, it's usually a train wreck, right? You know, people, if they point out that you did something wrong at work, it's like, oh my God, they're trying to get me fired or anything like that. No, no, no. In a debrief and in fighter aviation, if you don't get better, you're going to get killed or you're going to kill me. And then I'm going to be really pissed off.
See, that's the element there. It's not just yourself that we're talking about.
Exactly. That's exactly right. So, and another concept I like teaching companies about, we have something called a SPA, not like a $300 back rub.
Not laying back? Okay.
No, no. It's a single point of accountability. Like in the business world, there might be 10 people assigned a problem, right? Hey, all you 10 folks do this. And it's an absolute clown car. Who on that team has 51% of the vote, right? We call them a single point of accountability. Because here's what's going to happen. If the 10 people doing something, it fails, and I try and knock out a debrief, okay, so why does this fail? Who was in charge? Well, you know, you hear crickets chirping. Yeah. You know, no, I'm not talking to the mouse in my pocket. Who owned this? I don't care if 10 of you were executing it. One of you owned it. So a SPA, single point of accountability. So all these, I got to be honest with you, coming from the military to the business world, I assumed a lot of these things were in there. So it's funny, when I give a keynote or do like business workshops, I got to be honest with you, man, I feel bad about taking the money a little bit because I'm like, this is, you guys make money in spite of yourselves. And then when I introduce some of these, I think it's like breathing to me, when I introduce some of these concepts to businesses, they're like, oh my God, you're brilliant. I'm like, I ain't the sharpest tool in the shed, man, but, you know, I take what I've learned and applied it. One of the good things that we do is a red team. So if you and I were briefing to go drop some bombs in northern Iraq, you and I had planned for an hour. We got satellite images. We got intel. We're looking a couple hours of planning. You and I would be like, we're brilliant. There's no way in hell this plan is going to fail. And then we'd launch and get shot down. Here's what we do after we plan. Before we go flying, let's go grab 2-3 other pilots who aren't flying with us and they weren't in our planning, but they know what the hell's going on. We sit them down and we say, fellas, here's our mission objective. Here's how we want to get it done. And then what do you got? And they just go, ch-ch, and they start, boom, they become our enemy. They start blasting holes in our plan. Did you think about this? Dude, there's a missile site right there.
Set another set of eyes and ears on it.
Another set of eyes. They become the enemy. We call it the red team because in the 80s, Navy SEALs used to dress like Soviets, and they try and infiltrate our submarine.
It's a great methodology to implement in business when you see who, you know, a lot of people. I like that a lot. Makes a lot of sense.
Especially in like a law firm or something like this. Somebody be opposing. Somebody rip me apart. You be the other dude, you know? So in the military, you have to do that.
Look at all the angles.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Different perspectives.
You bet.
Listen, businesses, small, medium, or large, all industries, bottom line. Talk about the bottom. They all want to increase the revenue. They all want to be more profitable. Exactly. They all want to be more productive. They're hungry for tools. And I think when you look at, you know, you look at the tools you provide in a book like this, it's not just for people that are ex-military as well. I want to make sure our viewers and listeners understand that. You don't have to have a military background to understand that or start implementing these strategies.
Matter of fact, if you're a little bit more divorced from the military or have zero experience, it really applies because it isn't.
Like, you're not set in your ways, maybe.
It ain't rocket surgery. I remember when I had a buddy. When I first started flight school, one of my buddies, his first flight to flight school was on an airliner. He went to like University of Montana, you know, somewhere in the Midwest. Dude had never been on a – flew to Pensacola, Florida for flight school. And I had another buddy in that class who had 6,000 hours in a Learjet, you know, business jets, but he went to serve his country. The dude with 6,000 hours almost failed out. And the guy who was a clean slate. So you're right. This book and my methodologies actually take a little bit – the folks who have prior military experience in the business world I work with, they're like, dude, I've been saying this stuff for years at this place. They're not listening to me. Thank God you came in here and said it from a stage. And I'm like, wow, man, this isn't tough. So, yeah, at a lot of these methodologies, you know, we call it a continuous improvement cycle. We plan. We red team the plan. We brief. We get people in a room and we do a brief. And it's not called a long, right? This is called a brief. We're going to hold a 15-minute brief about what the execution is going to be.
Keyword brief there, right?
It's a brief, man. I don't go to business meetings. They're either a brief, a debrief, or a status update. you send me a meeting request, it's declined. I want to know what it is, how long it's going to last, and what the objectives are, right? So it's...
Well, time management in business is crucial, too. And you think about how much time you save when you execute plans like that.
Dude, if I'm scheduled for 1 o'clock, I showed up, 15 minutes early today. If you're not 15 minutes early, you're late. In a fighter squadron, if there's a brief at 1 o'clock for a mission, and you come strolling in with your venti upside down unicorn frappuccino, first of all, you can't stroll in because we lock the door. How can we expect you to put a bomb through a window plus or minus 2 seconds if you can't make it to the brief on time?
Certainly.
And that also sets the tone of the execution. If you're having a big meeting to kick off a product launch or a case or whatever it is, you're not prepared, the slides ain't loading, people are strolling in at 1:15, the mission's going to suck. You have got to be disciplined in your presentation. Everybody's got to be there on time. If you see, you know, Discovery Channel had a great, like, I don't know, 10-part series on the Blue Angels, man. That's why they look good, and it is nearly flawless. But if you also know, you know, the Blue Angels fly for about four – I got to fly with them in Oklahoma City. They fly for 45 minutes. They debrief for about 3 hours. They got videotapes of the flight. I mean, they go through every detail. Why? So they can get better. It's all about improving execution, man. And as you said, at companies that I do debriefing workshops with, when I teach their companies how to debrief, I think the lowest report I've ever gotten was like, you know, we increased our performance or sales or income 30%. I've seen wow. numbers around 50 to 100%. People are like, well, think about it. In the business world, if you did something big and it failed, everybody kind of looks at the smoking wreckage and goes, oh, that sucked. All right, on to the next big thing, we got to get going. Or, hey, man, that was awesome. I can't believe we hit it out of the park. All right, on to, I'm the guy saying stop. Nobody goes anywhere. Why is there a smoking wreckage right here? Or why did we print money? Because we want to either avoid this again or do this again, right? So, again, it's not – I'm not the sharpest tool in the shed, so I just kind of put it into a nice, easy-to-use format to help people out.
I want to transition a little bit and make sure we're listening. Everyone that's viewing, listening, make sure you could go right on Amazon and grab this book, From mm-hmm. C-Level to C-Level. Make sure you hop on Amazon and take advantage. It's an amazing read, and so many different businesses could obviously benefit from this, whether you're, you know, a sole operator and, like we were saying earlier, industry, all across of industry, small, medium, large. So awesome tools there to improve your business. I wanted to talk to you just because I'm just trying to educate myself a little bit about the military and kind of the inner workings. And I'm reading so many just negative articles about what's going on with the Department of Veteran Affairs. What's kind of your take on that, you know, as a veteran? What's going on? How can we improve this? Is it broken?
It's a national disgrace.
Wow.
You don't even want to get me started on the VA. First of all, watching a Democratic presidential debate where everybody agrees that we should be giving health care to illegal immigrants, my face melted off. First of all, we have 60,000 homeless veterans in this country. 22 veterans kill themselves a day. The VA in Arizona killed 7 people. There's been 3 or 4 deaths where they're actually prosecuting people finally in the VA. Here's my story with the VA. I can't hear a thing. I flew jets for 15 years. I have 10 unitis, which almost drives me to the point to not be. It's just, it's maddening. The VA, in their own manual, it says, hey, if you're an aviator, you get an automatic 10% disability. I'm like, okay, I filed for that. They denied it. And here's why they denied it. So I'm leaving. So the one time, big time I lie in my life, you ready for this? I'm leaving the Navy. And when you do your separation physical, they're like, hey, is there anything wrong with you? And I'm like, yeah, there's a ton wrong, but guess what I'm trying to do? I'm trying to go be an airline pilot.
Once you tell them that, you have no career after.
Yeah. Well, no. So yes and no. Okay. You're gonna love and hate this. So half the guys in my class that were separating, they had the gouge. We call it the intel. They're like, dude, put your quadriplegic down that you're dying, and you'll get all these benefits and this and stuff. I'm like, you can't, dude. You're going to fly for FedEx. You got an FAA physical. They're like, man, those systems don't talk. I'm like, this is our government. They're pretty smart. Guess who was wrong? Me. So I put down that I had absolutely nothing wrong with me. No hearing loss.
Because you're thinking of your future.
Pulling 9 Gs for 15 years. My back's killing me. My neck. There's so much wrong with me. So half the room has been getting ton of health care and benefits. And the other half of the guys like me. I bring this up because guess what? Recently, I think about my buddy sent me a link to about 15 Southwest airline pilots who have gotten fired because now Uncle Sam FAA is going, well, wait a minute. Can we see what you put in your medical records? So you did lie on your FAA form that you didn't have anything wrong with you. So I'm in the process. 5 years, man. I actually had to get a VA attorney type of thing. And I'm not, you know, I got – it ain't for the money. It's not needed. It's now it's for the damn issue, right? It's – I'm not some staff sergeant who was kicking open doors and blowing guys' heads off at 3 feet. Those guys have zero resources to fight. I got the resources to hire an attorney because now I'm pissed. But the VA, man, I can't even – the president's done a he's really trying – he actually had to pass a law to be able to fire people at the VA. Huh. You couldn't get fired. Hey, you gave that guy penicillin and he died. You know, we'll transfer –
no repercussion at all.
Zero. Now they can get fired. But still, you know what firing a guy in the government is like? 2 years of this, an appeal of that, and maybe you keep your – it's – so we take our national treasure, our young women and men who are suffering, and we screw them. And then to have people in this country running to lead it, saying that, hey, man, somebody breaks the law, jumps a fence, gets more health care than you, who was kicking doors in Fallujah. I'm furious. It's awful. We are screwing our veterans in this country, and they're dying.
What is the solution?
Well, first of all, the solution would be prioritize 60,000 homeless veterans. The solution would be to go
that
after –
that number is staggering.
It's awful. And I think that's on the low side.
That's really heartbreaking.
Yeah. It's 60,000. Dude, they're living on the streets. My God, we got people – they're living in prison camps. I'll bet you some of these veterans who are kind of used to living in, quote, a prison camp. I got a cot. I got 3 square meals a day. Hell, that's better living than I got in the Marine Corps. But the president is at least trying to do some better top-down accountability with the VA. It's sad to say, Evan, but sometimes when these bureaucracies get to a certain point, they take on this own – you know, black hole of just sucking in nothingness. It really would be a complete and total destruction of the VA to start again. The president has started allowing, you know, the wait times in the Arizona VA case, they were lying about, right? Like, because they got bonuses, man. VA employees would get bonuses for like, our wait times in, decreased. Oh, here's, you know, $5,000. You guys are doing a great job. Dude dies in a parking lot. So the president has actually signed a law that says you can go get health care out in town, because before it was like, no, you're a vet. You need to – hey, man, there's a hospital next door, and they should be prioritized. So there are some fixes, but, I mean, I'm a perfect example. I'm fighting to this day to get
– Well, I'm sure that the other veterans are going to appreciate that. So obviously yeah. It's not just a personal issue here. It's going to be –
And here's what's funny, is Evan, is they can even give you – the VA can classify you as 0% disabled – but zero is a number, and you can still be classified as one. I'm like talking to my VA attorney. He's like, dude, you're about 40 to 50% disabled and nothing.
You talk about years of G-force, you know, on your body. Can you describe it for someone, our viewers, listeners, that never experienced that? If you could put that into words, what does that feel like?
So I had a big dinner last night, but let's say just on average I weigh 200 pounds. At 200 pounds, when I pull 9 G's in the aircraft, I weigh 1,800 pounds. So it's like a safe, like a big safe sitting on you in the cockpit.
How do you even breathe?
Well, here's what happens. I'll send you a link to a video clip of me dogfighting, and you can hear me, and it don't make fun of the heavy breathing in it. But so you teach a hook maneuver. So first of all, you wear a G suit, like really tight Miami Metro dude skinny jeans, right? They're really tight, and it's plugged into the aircraft. So it senses when you're pulling G's, they actually inflate. So on your legs and your waist, these things inflate and squeeze your legs and your abdomen. Why? Because when you're pulling G's, your blood's leaving your head. And I don't know if you passed out lately. I certainly have. What's the first thing to go when you're feeling lightheaded? Your vision, right? Mm-hmm. So we'll get tunnel vision, right?
I gave blood a couple weeks ago. I got a little woozy. Exactly. I'm a wuss.
So, yeah, so when you pull G's, the blood's leaving your head, so they squeeze your legs and your abdomen to try and put the blood
keep
up
the
in your head.
Wow, okay, I didn't know that.
And we had to, I mean, man, we were working out 2-3 times a day. You know, I still do, but, you know, squat, legs, abs, you have to have really strong leg and ab muscles to try and squeeze that blood back up in your head. Because there's actually, you can search on Google or YouTube, there are flights, you know, there's videos of guys just, you know, do a maneuver, black out, and fly right into the desert floor. Now, they have CFIT, controlled flight into terrain avoidance. So the jet says, boom, wait, this guy's going down. Hey, you wake, and it'll recover. But that came out years after I was flying. I know two dudes who flew perfectly good airplanes, one into the water and one into the side of a mountain by blacking out.
Just because their body couldn't take it.
They were out.
You don't realize how much physical, you think, oh, I don't have to be in shape, I'm flying a plane, but you don't realize the actual physical strength you need.
No, it's brutal. A 45-minute dogfight, I get out, I'm drenched. And that's the other thing. I mean, my flight surgeon, our flight surgeon used to tell us over drinks, he's like, you guys don't even want to know what's going on in your brain and the blood vessels. And he's like, you're almost likely going to die of an aneurysm. I'm like, okay, doc, thanks.
It's scary.
It's awful. I mean, and, you know, the people that have kind of, you know, done this type of stuff, like we just said with the VA, it's just kind of, you get this, here's your thank you. I don't get a penny from, I did 15 years. I don't get a cent in retirement. Nope. Not a retirement, no health care.
That's a broken system then.
There's other kind of Brazil. I know in Brazil, if you do a minimum of 2 years, you get a lifetime pension.
That's it, two years.
Other countries where I did 15, you need to do 20. I'm like, that's great. Two combat deployments on the Abraham Lincoln, the Kitty Hawk. I feel like dog squeeze. And here's your photocopied honorable discharge letter.
Well, I think that it's important that you have a voice now and you're really trying to make a difference, man. Yeah. So we appreciate that. There's a lot of people that are obviously a lot worse than you, like you said. So
oh God, no, man, I'm fine to put it to be brutally honest. I'm doing it on principle, mm-hmm. not on. I mean, I feel like dog squeeze sometimes. The hearing, the tendonitis, it really is like a jet noise just continuous in my ears. It's maddening. I would have kicked my own ass if I ever heard that I was meditating, but I have to do so many things because it's incurable. You can't cure tendonitis, and every fighter pilot I know has it. So we're all kind of struggling in silence, you know? So, yeah, so I am. We have a saying in the military, you put the ladder down. One of the reasons I left Wall Street in Chicago and moved down to South Florida was to start my own firm. Was the whole Wall Street, they'd push their own mother in front of a bus to make a dollar. In the military, that wasn't what you were taught. You were taught to put the ladder down. You make it in a higher rank. I got to go to Top Gun. When you're at Top Gun, you know, you learn to be an instructor. So you don't come back, we call it going to the mountain. You don't come back from the mountain and you're flowing robes full of knowledge and say, well, I'm brilliant. No, you turn around and you teach everybody what you just learned up on the mountain. So you put the ladder down and help other people.
I like that analogy.
Yeah, Wall Street, they pull the ladder up. Hey, man, look at my bonus. Look at my house in the Hamptons. They pull the ladder up in the military. And in the business world, man, I try and teach people, you know, when I speak to them, put the ladder down. You'll be seen as a greater human being than somebody who pulls it up, man. And it's sad that we got to talk about issues like that because I was raised like that, and then being in the military, they kind of beat it in you. But by now, that's the way I'm raising my kids. So hopefully, I'm going to make the world a little bit of a better place.
No, you definitely will, and you're making businesses a lot better as well. And you'd read this book. Look, businesses. We're talking execution. We're talking planning. We're talking strategy, and we're talking leadership. Mm-hmm. You put those four elements in and you utilize them properly, like you said, you're going to see an increase in productivity, profitability, which is everyone's ultimate goal.
You can't. You can't not. If you do the things you just laid out, unless you're literally a rock, you're going to be doing better.
Excellent. Well, before we take off here, any other stories? Did you have to like sign an NDA? Can you tell us a couple things? Like, tell me something that you're not. Let's get a little in trouble here. We want to hear something. I need to hear a story when you were in that jet. What you did? What you saw? I know you got a lot of skeletons in there. We're gonna pull something out of here from Matthew Buckley, the Wiz.
One of the funniest thing. I'll go with a funny one. I mean, Perfect. Most of my flying over Iraq was boring. I got to be honest with you. The toughest flying I did in the Navy was up at Top Gun. Why? Because kind of like the red team, we're harder on ourselves in training. So when we go meet Mr. or Mrs. Bad Guy, they're a letdown. So flying over Iraq was kind of a letdown, to be honest with you. But one time, so we launched off the USS Abraham Lincoln, and we go over Saudi Arabia. That's where the tankers are. You know, they're out of enemy airspace. And going to get my gas. So I go off the tanker. And I start going into Iraq, and all of a sudden my right engine starts just boom, 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 making, you know, these really bad noises. noises are bad usually in an aircraft. So it was a hydraulic pump coming apart. So one of the things that it says to do is to shut down the engine. So shut down the engine, and this is, I think it was July or August. It was July or August, and it's hot as hell, right? Obviously, in the middle of the Persian Gulf, it's the heat of hell. And I'm single engine. I got a lot of bombs on board, a lot of missiles, and I'm full of fuel because I just hit the tanker. So I'm sitting here on one engine up at altitude, and I can't maintain altitude because I'm fat, full of fuel, and I got a lot of bombs. I don't want to be jettisoning the bombs right over innocent people. So I'm, you know, I'm descending. I'm like, well, there's no way in hell I can make it out to the ship back into the Persian Gulf. The closest divert field was Kuwait International Airport. So I'm like, I declared an emergency, and I said, hey, I got to go land at Kuwait International. So I'm descending, which is fine now because I need to descend. But to start slowing my descent as I got closer to the airport, I need to squirt, you know, my
left. Drop fuel?
Now I'm dumping fuel just out of the back. And you're supposed to stop dumping fuel below 6,000 feet. Above 6,000 feet, it vaporizes, it atomizes. Below 6, it doesn't. Doesn't matter, man, because I'm in, you know, I'm on full power as much as I can on the left engine, and I'm still descending. Now I'm going through 6,000 feet. Now I got to squirt a little afterburner on that left engine to try and add more lift. But before I do that, a big page in the flight manual comes up that says, if you're single engine and you're dumping fuel and you select afterburner on the other engine, you might turn into a big freaking Roman candle. Think about it. So you're dumping fuel out of the back of the airplane, and then you're going to light the afterburner on the other motor. They're like, if you got to do it.
It doesn't sound like a good combination.
I had to do it. Wow. Right? It was either that or I'm just going to fly into the dirt. I can't with just – it's called military power. So that's full afterburner, and then below that's military. So I'm like, oh, man. Now I'm flying right over downtown Kuwait. I mean, this is downtown. I'm at about 1,000 feet. And I'm like, I have to select afterburner, or I'm just going to pancake into the ground. And I already said I'm going to ride it in. I'm like, I'm not going to kill a couple hundred Kuwaitis, man. I'm like, well, it was a good life. So I, just gently go in the afterburner and kind of close my eyes. I'm like, okay, I'm still here. So I'm in full afterburner now, and I fly right over the emir's palace. Because I'm going, they're like, hey, you have to deviate. I'm like, nope, I'm going straight. So I'm dumping fuel, full afterburner at 1,000 feet over Kuwait City, and I barely make it to the runway, almost land short of the runway, and land and, you know, and make it. Wow. And they had like a rescue crew there from the Kuwaiti Air Force. They came out and, you know, I hop out of the airplane. The first thing they do is they bring me in this trailer. It's a little creepy, to be honest with you, even though it's Kuwait. I'm like, somebody can cut my head off or something. The guy's like, Major Hassan, I forget his last name. He's like, Mr. Wiz. He's like, you flew over the presidential palace dumping fuel over the king. I'm like, now I got like images of Midnight Run in my in my head. I'm like, okay, is this going to hurt? You know? And he's like, no. They put me up at this 5-diamond hotel or something like that in Kuwait. It was on the front page of the paper the next day about this. But I was treated more like a hero than anything. Wow. But let me share one more, because this one.
That's a good one. The fuel spray over the palace. I like that one.
I cleaned it up a little bit. So you'll get a kick out of this one, man. I'm an instructor pilot at Miramar in California. And I was a senior pilot, and we got a brand new jet. This thing, it flew from St. Louis to Miramar. So it's sitting on the ramp. It's got nothing hanging on it, like no drop tanks for fuel, nothing. I mean, this thing, she's slick.
Lean and mean.
Clean, mean, still, you know, the cockpit had new car smell. But before we could turn it over students, you had to do an acceptance flight, like make sure everything's working. So I was one of the senior guys. So I take off, and it's got the brand new EPE, Enhanced Performance Engines. So I get on the runway in San Diego and Miramar. I plug in the afterburners, man. I'm like, I'm on the back of the jet already.
I'm going to break this baby in, huh?
Oh, my God, yes. So I get going down the runway. I'm airborne before I even expect I should be airborne. I'm like, oh, this is going to be good. So get out over the Pacific, San Diego. Beautiful day. Blue Pacific, not a cloud in the sky. it takes all of, I don't know, 8 to 10 minutes to knock out the checklist to accept. And now I got a whole bag of gas. And I'm like, okay, here we go.
Everything checked out now. Let's have some fun.
Yeah. Uh-oh. So the book says, the F-18 flight manual says 50,000 feet is the service ceiling. I'm like, okay, let's go check that out. So I plug in a full afterburner, about 20, 25,000 feet. And this thing's climbing, going up. You know, this is literally a rocket. So I am hauling the speed of heat, going up, you know, 30,000, 35,000, 40,000, 45,000. And I hit 50, and I'm still climbing. I'm like, man, there ain't no ceiling on here, baby. Let's keep going. So I go through about 55,000 feet, 56. Dude, curvature of the Earth. You can see it was space. It's space. You're on the edge of space.
Wow.
It's black and it's blue. I'd never seen that before.
I'm That's like, fascinating.
Son of, yeah, it was an absolute moment of peace. It was, you know, later I thought about if I had a pinhole in the cockpit, you know, my whole body would have been sucked out or anything. It didn't matter at the time. I'm like, this is absolutely beautiful. I've never seen anything like it. Black, blue.
So all our viewers out there, the Earth is not flat.
No, it's, I saw it, man. It's round. I was there. So get up to about 59,000 feet, and all of a sudden, boom, ba-boom, boom, boom.
Oh, no.
There's no air. I'm not in a rocket. I'm in – I got two engines that need air. They're coughing. They're like – they're choking. I'm like, oh, boy.
And how high are you?
I think – Is this being recorded? I'm out now, actually. What are they going to do? Now give me VA benefits? I almost made it to 60,000 feet. So now I'm like, I got my altitude record. Now I'm going to go for what? Speed. So and I
– You're not nosediving this thing back down to Earth, are you?
Some bitch I am. Watch this. Oh, so I just kind of moved the stick, you know, full left, and it kind of – you know, I'm like in a bathtub, man. It just kind of rolls over because there's no air up there. So I point straight down at the Pacific, and of course it looks pretty far away, man. There's, you know, the San Clemente Island and stuff like that. I'm like, I leave it full afterburner in there, and I just start going straight down, and I'm hauling ass. I mean, literally. And I think I saw Mach was 1.7 in the indicator. So I'm going from 60,000 feet, and right around 25,000 feet, I'm doing what, 1,900 miles an hour. Now, you know, I'm a political science major, so I'm slow with the math. At about 25,000 feet, I'm like, I better start pulling out. And I pulled the throttles to idle. And since I'm going that fast, actually slowing down threw me forward. I'm like.
It jerked you forward?
Yep. And then here's where this gets bad. So in the F-18 and in most modern fighters or aircraft, you're a voting member. There ain't no pull on the stick, there's cables and stuff that move, right? This isn't the Wright brothers. Now you're a voting member. So when I went full aft stick, the flight control computer said, okay, Wiz wants to go full aft stick. Well, guess what? We're doing 1,900 miles per hour, and if we do that, we're all going to vaporize into little carbon pieces. So it just started pulling out a little bit. I'm like, oh, shit. That, you know, now me sleeping through that aerodynamics class, I'm like, oh, shit. So I got full-ass stick in my lap, and now I really start doing math. I'm like, I'm going to hit the Pacific Ocean. I'm going to fly right, you know, maybe 1,000 feet is where I'm doing the math really quick now, and I'm like, oh, my God. Absolute peace. I'm sitting there. Well, here's the first thing I thought of. I'm like, the guys are going to go to the Officers Club today for my memorial, and they're going to be laughing at how stupid I was. So that's what I was most concerned about. And then I thought about my wife and my, you know, my family, and I'm like, oh, my God.
You have your priorities straight, right?
Yeah. I'm like, this is how it ends? I'm like, I'm wondering what it's going to feel like when I hit the water. Because here's the other thing. People are like, dude, why don't you eject? If you eject at 1,900 miles an hour, there's nothing, you vaporize. So it's essentially going from us sitting here. Imagine a force of 1,900 miles an hour of wind. You vaporize. Yeah, the flight surgeon told me, they're like, dude, we would have maybe found a piece of your boot. You would have, the molecules, everything in your body disintegrates. So you couldn't eject, and then the jet's just kind of doing its own little thing. So I'm going through all this stuff in my mind. I'm like, what's it going to feel like to die? Hey, it's a beautiful day. You know, I got an itch here. I'm like, it's all random, but I was at absolute peace. And I go through 10,000 feet. 5,000 feet. Now the air's getting thicker, right? So now the stability are starting to bite a little bit more. And I'm like, oh, shit, man, I think we got this, you know. I shit you negative, man. I bottomed out at 150 feet above the Pacific. And there's two mirrors on the canopy. There's a big old fishtail right behind me.
Wow.
So I climb back up.
You put the danger zone song, I think, might have been written for you, man.
So I'm flying back to Miramar. I got like my Lucky Strike cigarette out, you know, putting it out on my forehead and with my scarf at the cockpit. I land and I walk by the maintenance guys. You know, the chief's like, "Hey, sir, how's the jet?" I'm like, I didn't even say anything. I'm like, I just kind of give him I go right up to my office, man. I reach down. I got my emergency bottle of Captain Morgan, you know, in the bottom right-hand drawer. And I'm like, you know, sitting here because I know what's going to happen next, right? Because, you know, 15, 20 minutes later after
couple. They're coming knocking, right? You knew that's coming.
Skipper wants to see you. I'm like, of course he does. Because the jet's a tattletale. All these jets, when you land, the maintenance guys don't get, you know, they'll say, "How's the jet?" But they go to the little bed. We call her Betty. Betty pops all these codes. It says, "I need this for fluid." Well, Betty, you know,
they must have thought it was wrong. They must have said, "There's like no way you did this.
It's a brand new airplane, dude." So I go into this guy's, it was a Marine squadron. I was a Navy guy. I was like on an exchange tour, and Marines are Marines. And, so, of course, I have to be standing at it. I feels like a week. I'm standing at attention, drilling my eyes into the wall. He's like, "So, did you scare yourself?" "Yes, sir." "You ever going to do that again?" "No, sir." "Get the fuck out of my office." I had a get out of jail free card for some stuff I had done. Obviously, that we can't talk about.
So use that.
That was my chip.
Wow.
So the jet. Here was also my punishment. So the jet became what we call a hangar queen. I literally broke the wings on an airplane. This brand new $60 million aircraft. Snap. Broke the wings. So that sat in the hangar, and they used it for parts. You know, they'd steal parts off of it for other airplanes until that, like, crew from St. Louis came out, and they had to re-wing the airplane.
So that was my $60 million excursion. I used to have to walk, you know, I'd walk out to go flying every day, and I'm like, "Oh, there she is."
So you have to keep reminding yourself.
Yeah. So that was it, man. So that there's an Iraq one, and there's a peacetime one.
Listen, you did a lot of great for our country, obviously, for only to walk away with that with a slap on the wrist. So that's a crazy story. Yeah. That's insane. We're glad you're here
We'll go grab a beer, and I'll tell you how I earned Wiz.
I'd like to hear that.
That's a 10-drink minimum.
10-drink minimum. Find out how he got the call sign Wiz. Man, we appreciate your time.
Make
sure, viewers, listeners, go on to Amazon, grab this book right now, From C-Level to C-Level. So many tips, strategies, execution, leadership. It will certainly help you take your business to the next level, even personally. So many amazing tips and strategies. Again, we appreciate your time.
You bet, man.
Mr. Buckley, you are a hero in my book, so we appreciate it. Keep fighting, though, for that VA, for all those veterans, man. Hate to hear that. I'm going to look into some nonprofit organizations that are helping the veterans that are homeless. Because I didn't realize that number was so staggering.
It's awful.
Crazy stuff. But viewers, listeners, thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of the Talk Golden to Me video podcast. Evan Golden, your host, appreciates it. He appreciates it. Like, share, comment. Give us all that attention. It helps us bring on guests like this, and we appreciate it. Till next time, tune in as always. We are out of here.